Welcome to the Story Mine. My name is David Bullock, and I'm here with my co-host,
Kathy Barker.
The Story Mine, I believe, is a wonderful resource of wealth. Wealth. You know, up here in Park City, we had wealth of minerals that made this town rich. And now we have a wealth of skiing opportunities and athletic opportunities that continues to make this town rich. But in both histories of Park City have been stories. And we excavate, Kathy and I, we dig deep into the story mine to find the stories that are interesting.
One of the things we really like to spotlight on the Story Mine are family stories. Today is Father's Day, and I have fond memories of my father, James Barker. He took us on many adventures out into the mining country, camping. I learned how to build a fire when I was only 6 years old, and by 8 years old, I was cutting my own wood. That was one thing about my dad. He always encouraged us to find our way and do exciting and interesting things. My dad was a mathematician, a sailor. He served honorably in World War II. The one thing I knew about my dad was that he always had time for me and he always loved me. I miss you, Daddy. Rest in peace. We are pleased to hear from several storytellers who are going to share some of their family tales as well. In the Story Mine today, we have Lamont Peterson. We're also going to be privileged to hear from a talented writer and storyteller, Christian Reel. And lastly, we'll hear from our very own Dave Bullock. He'll be sharing a story near and dear to his heart called The Long Road. I'm so excited to introduce our first storyteller, Lamont Peterson. Lamont is a son, a brother, a husband, and a father.
It's good to have you here, Lamont.
Well, it's good to be here.
Would you have family stories that you'd like to share with us today?
Certainly. This story I call Anyone Can Dance. I remember growing up and my parents teaching dance. They taught a foxtrot or a waltz or swing or disco. Lots of fun. I'm the oldest of six kids. It went two boys and then two girls. So once the girls were about, four or five, we had dance partners and we also learned to dance. My parents, they had even competed and won competitions. They had participated in large dance festivals. When I was 13 and 14, they were put in charge of a large dance festival in Boise area. They had me and my dance partner teaching one of those dances, a swing, to about 700 people. So we would go from one group of people to another every weekend and many nights of the week teaching them. But my parents had taught me the whole thing, and I was able to go out and teach it, and that was a lot of fun. But something I learned during that process was that my dad can't keep a beat. He doesn't have a sense of tempo. He really cannot detect the rhythmic beat in music. Now, wait a minute. Doesn't the guy lead in dancing, you might be asking? Well, yes, and my father does. But somehow, with the two of them, my mother gives him the cues or the clues about where the beat is, and he still leads, and they dance. And they accomplished, and they taught, and they won competitions. So when I tell you, hey, even if you don't got a sense of rhythm, it's possible to dance. You'd best believe me.
Thanks for being with us, Lamont.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, I'm Christian Reel. I wrote this piece as a memoir for my dad, who died in 1998. I was asked by my brother to write something, and this is the piece that came out. So this is the first time I've really shared it with people outside my family and a few close friends. So it's a fun experience for me. The piece is called The Trumpeter. The The video showed an interior of a beautiful European cathedral with a full orchestra. The orchestra was playing quietly, and then a striking young blonde stood next to the conductor and brought the trumpet to her lips. Me being male, one might think that this vision may have had an appeal, which is pretty natural to explain. I'll be honest, the natural male response was present for a moment, but it was the piece being played on the video which made the experience memorable. Haydn's Trumpet Concerto in E-flat, third movement, is written for trumpet masters. Having had some experience with brass instruments, I can appreciate the skill it takes to play Haydn's work, a level of skill I never achieved. I believe any musician can sense the challenge Haydn put on his musicians. Hearing this trumpet concerto for the first time in over 15 years, it sounded as familiar to me as the national anthem Take Me Out to the Ball Game, or RESPCT. I was transported back to a simpler time, a time I didn't appreciate when I was living in it, but I still miss. Amazingly, all the emotion came from a YouTube video I stumbled upon on Facebook. The female trumpet player on the video is named Allison Balsam. This is something I discovered purely on an intellectual pursuit. Once in an interview with a local English channel, she gave the most interesting answer to a question I'd heard. Allison was asked if her popularity and her being young would make classical music more appealing to a general audience. It was her skillful answer that resonates with me today. Allison said that classical music is meant to be not immediately accessible. This made her skillful play even more poignant. Sunday afternoons at our family's house often had a routine. We'd come home from church, change out of our Sunday clothes, and set the table for dinner. After dinner, we would congregate around the front porch, and Dad would bring out his trumpet and begin to play. Haydn's piece was what he used to warm up. This is why Allison Bolson's astute answer struck me. Classical music is intended to be sophisticated and not immediately accessible. But Dad's love of classical music was often less than sophisticated, and he himself was often less than sophisticated. One might say this is one of the delicious contradictions of my dad. Not only would he play the trumpet on the porch, which always seemed to me like a strange Norman Rockwell scene, he played a classical piece on the porch in a town of 100 people, full of farmers and Vietnam vets. I'm pretty sure they didn't have a great appreciation for Haydn. To add to this list of contradictions, Dad often played his impromptu trumpet recital in a pair of bib overalls while changing up his musical repertoire with mariachi tunes and an occasional smattering of jazz riffs and the final Flight of the Bumblebee. Dad was the son of a casket factory foreman. He was from a small farming town outside of Philadelphia. His early years were spent in the orchards or the Rust Belt towns of eastern Pennsylvania, with exotic and familiar names like Boyertown, Lancaster, or Reading. Remember the old Billy Joel song, "We're Living Here in Allentown"? Those two towns, Bethlehem and Allentown, made famous by shuttering factories, were also part of Dad's old stomping ground. It was in this unlikely place where he first learned his love for classical music, with singing, and then in the end with his mastery of the trumpet. For a time, he was a professional trumpet player. But his latter jobs often weren't what one would think a professional trumpet player might do. After moving to Utah, he was a pipe welder, a long-haul truck driver, and a used car salesman. But there were times when his passion for music and sound led him to work as a recording engineer. Eventually, we had a recording studio in our own house. He would use the massive speakers in his studio to blast classical music through our neighborhood. This was only during the downtimes, of course, when he wasn't recording one of the local Baptist choirs, Czech folk singers, or political fight songs. He was an unapologetic Republican, but from time to time his Rust Belt sensibilities would come through in statements like, "Reagan and his kind only have dollar signs in their eyes." He was a convert to Mormonism, but he was much more comfortable in the company of the Baptist congregations. His best friend was from that congregation. James was one of the very small group of Salt Lake City black adults who had actually grown up in Utah. James and Dad liked to see the shock on people's face when they would introduce each other as brothers. Dad also found great joy in mocking the local Utah culture. He would sit around during services and make fun of the old state hymns, like, Utah, Utah, bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. Oft-times, Dad's exasperation for simpletons was palpable. When he would talk about having lived in New England, the confused local would respond, "That must have been quite a boat ride." Contrarily, he loved Utah and he loved his religion. There was little he enjoyed more than discussing scripture, unless, of course, he could do something church-involved with his trumpet. He enjoyed car rides in the country and hiking local Utah mountain passes. He loved concerts in Salt Lake City and the old buildings which hosted them. I can hardly walk by those old buildings without thinking of the time spent in those uncomfortable benches, listening to a choir singing in medieval Italian, or something else not immediately accessible. This was the nature of everything my dad loved. Now many of those things are what I love, which make them more precious when we learn to love them. One of the many lessons I learned from him, of course, long, long after he said them. His relationship with modern music was just as complex as his relationship to anything. He spoke longingly of the time in his music store in Scranton when he first heard Bob Dylan. His respectful tone for Dylan nearly caused me to fall off my chair. He was often so critical of singers who were off-key, and I have yet to hear a recording of Bob where he was on-key. Later, his tastes were at times even more inconsistent. One day the music I was playing was interesting. 3 days later, it was more like, "Turn off that devil worship." One day, my older brother was listening to the band A Flock of Seagulls on his Walkman. When Dad heard the music coming through the cheap headset, he instantly announced how awful it sounded. Looking back at this, I didn't think anything sounded good when someone was listening through those cheap headsets across the room. At any rate, my brother calmly handed Dad the Walkman and the headset, briefly explained the name of the band. Dad grumpily put on the headphones, listened intently until he was satisfied for some unknown reason. Handing everything back to my brother, he answered in a conciliatory tone, "Not too bad." Then his eyes narrowed and his forehead furrowed. "But what's with the name Floppy Seagulls?" For Dad, A Flock of Seagulls would remain somewhat inaccessible. Whether it was this inconsistency or my need to rebel, we didn't always get along. I found his boisterous nature and artistic mannerisms off-putting. I was often ashamed at my inability to be the musician he was. One day, we were visiting my older brother when Dad heard music being played at the nearby park. He instructed us all to prepare to follow him and find out who or where these performers were. In a classic chapter in his life, he was the conductor of the small-town band within weeks, growing their numbers and increasing their sets. Eventually, I was a member of the band, and so was my dubious band teacher. It was no coincidence that my band teacher's name was Dick. He was temperamental, prone to harass junior high-age girls, and he had bizarre fascinations with Michael Jackson. As was standard procedure in Dick's class, we had regular playing tests. I was often ill-prepared for these tests. But one particular time, my lack of preparedness was more obvious than ever. I squeaked out wrong note after miss note in a display that probably left every Siamese cat in the area sterile. Finally, Dick could hear no more. He spent the next 20 minutes screaming and jumping like a crazy person who had lost his magic hat, only pausing periodically to inform me that my father would be ashamed at my musical insubordination. This experience ended my quest to someday be a master horn player like Dad. I had to find something else to connect with his interests and passions. It was around this time I learned to love the sound and structure of music. I became like the food critic who can't cook. Years later, before he began to get really sick, Dad's distaste for popular music would become so strong he began to search for anything that sounded new or different. He'd buy South African tribal music, some experimental art music, and he and I found a common affinity to Haitian and other Caribbean sounds. Before he was stricken too ill to work, we even had a collective dream of working together in a radio station. That dream would soon be forgotten, as both of us and our priorities changed. Once the diabetes affected his eyes, then his kidneys, then his heart, and then began to take limbs, I spent time with him driving to and from doctor's appointments and caring for him and Mom in their house. It was small consolation that I was the only one who could get him to laugh in those last few months. But I'm not even sure that's true anymore. This is probably a story I told myself so that I could feel a level of unique closeness to him. Perhaps I wanted to believe I alone found the key to accessibility. Near the end of Dad's life, the trumpet remained unattended for greater and greater periods until eventually he was too sick to play it at all. Then he was too sick to spend time in the recording studio. It was around this time the trumpet was given to another family member. I'm not sure if this is to see someone else appreciate it or if he did this so he wouldn't have to look at it anymore. I began to resent the quiet Sunday afternoons. They were both foreign and unwanted. I was glad to be free of the sight of Dad's trumpet laying unattended by the closet while immediately accessible. Finally, nearly everything he was passionate about was placed to rest, and there he was lying in the bed quietly. Looking back on that moment, the silence around his bed was not as out of place as it probably should have been. However, even 5 years earlier, the word silent would have never been a word to explain Dad. That morning, the awkward emptiness of the room marked an end to a life flowered by music and silenced by illness. I watched the last of his life leave his tired body. Now when I hear the pieces he loved, played by others like Alison Balsam, I close my eyes and imagine, if just for a moment, that I'm back in that small town after a Sunday early dinner, and there he is, warming up.
What more can be said for the love of a father and a son? And now our very own Dave Bullock.
I was settling into Mind Camp life quite comfortably. My mommy had a soon-to-be teenage daughter and two troublesome teenage sons. That was plenty to manage without having a 4-year-old mischievous Davey around. So Daddy made arrangements with the camp cook, Esther, to watch over me while he worked at the mine. I'll never forget when Daddy took me in his Jeep to the mine tunnel. It was over a mile above the camp where Esther lived. I didn't know what a mile was, but with the Jeep, it didn't seem like that far. When we got to the tunnel, Daddy led me inside the dark mine. I was afraid at first, but Daddy held my hand and explained that he'd teach me how to be safe. "Davy, if you ever lose your light and find yourself in the dark, slide your feet along the mine rails, and they will either lead you into or out of the mine, depending on which way you want to go. Also, if you hear a rumbling noise, it's probably the miners pushing the ore car out of the tunnel. If you hear it, Davy, find the widest part of the tunnel and hug the wall, because if that ore car hits you, it could kill you." Well, one day, Esther was taking a nap, and I decided I'd walk up the road and go see my daddy. So I began walking up the mine road. I thought it'd be real close, but it wasn't. And I kept hiking up that trail, and the more I kept going up, the thirstier I got. My mouth dried up, and I couldn't swallow. I was tired, too, but I wanted to see my daddy, so I kept going. I hiked a long way, and I cried for my daddy, but he didn't come, so I kept hiking up that long, steep trail. Exhausted, I finally arrived at the mine, but nobody was there. That meant that I'd have to go into the darkness of the mine to see my daddy. As I walked into the mine, it got darker and darker. I didn't know it, but the mine tunnel was almost a mile long, and I knew that my daddy was all the way at the end of the tunnel. I shuffled my feet along the mine rails just like Daddy had told me to do. In the dark, I heard a rumble, and I knew that the ore car was coming. I was afraid that I was going to get smushed by that ore car, so I stepped off the rails and I hugged the wall. Moments later, I saw two miners pushing the ore car past me. They had their heads down, and they didn't even see me. So after they passed by, I kept scooting my feet on the mine rails until finally I saw my daddy drilling in the end of the tunnel with the jackhammer. It was so noisy. I tugged on Daddy's yellow slicker mucking pants. Feeling a tug, he looked around, but he didn't see me. I tugged again, and when he saw me, he just about jumped out of his pants. He was so surprised. "Who brought you up here, Davy?" I walked. "Where's Esther?" "She's taking a nap." "Well, how did you get back here without a light?"
"I scooted my shoes on the rails like you taught me to do, Daddy."
"Well, didn't you see the ore car, Davy?"
"Yes, Daddy, I hugged the wall just like you told me to."
My dad was so surprised that I'd come all the way to visit him, and so relieved that I'd made the long trip without incident, he told the miners to take the rest of the day off, because I'd made a special trip to see him, and he wanted to spend time with me. It was a special time, but that's another story.
What a touching story, Dave.
Thank you. Well, that's the end of our show. Make sure that you tell your father that you love him.
Happy Father's Day.
Goodbye.